This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello and welcome to All Things History, Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe. Program that reports on what has happened, so we might consequently find out what could happen. I'm Sue Robsky, and for the next hour, we'll explore topics around the American Revolution. We've basically been discussing that for the last few months, and today I thought we would discuss some lesser-known, lesser-discussed topics of the American Revolution, starting with Revolutionary Privateers, an article from Naval History Magazine. And then I'm going to follow that with Black Loyalists, the Blacks who did not support the Revolution and sided with the British because they felt there was really nothing for them in fighting on the side of the revolutionists who wanted to keep them enslaved. And I don't think it would be fair to not include a section about Black patriots. So that's what we'll do. So I'm going to start out. Naval history. Patriotism or profit? Well, this is by Ensign Samuel Yankee, U.S. Coast Guard. Prowling European coastlines, American privateers seized British prizes, lining their pockets and bolstering the patriot cause. Amid the crash of guns in July 1781, roaring men fought for their lives with pikes, cutlasses, and flintlock pistols. Splinters of oak sprayed across the decks, hidden in clouds of gun smoke and curls of flame. As one New England sailor looked up from the melee, the stained banner of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts began to quiver in its halyard, its pine tree and sacred mandate of an appeal to heaven soon disappeared into the chaos on deck. Uncertainty hung in the air for a moment until the British white ensign climbed steadily, boldly, to the masthead. The privateer Oliver Cromwell had been taken. The brigantine Cromwell began her fighting life 4 years earlier, in 1777. Driven out of Boston by the British naval blockade, the firm of Cabot, Lee, and Company had become a titan of investment in shipping and privateering out of Beverly, Massachusetts. In a petition to the Massachusetts General Court requesting a privateer's commission, the firm declared that the brigantine, registered at 160 tons, mounting 16 six-pounder guns, and sailed by 130 men, was designed to cruise against the enemies of the United States. Demonstrating her prowess as a frigate, the Cromwell cruised off Bilbao, a neutral Spanish port rich with British shipping. According to a letter written from that city to a London newspaper, the Cromwell, under Captain William Coles, captured 8 prizes in less than a month, including neutral flagged vessels carrying cargo from British ports. The Oliver Cromwell, crown jewel of Cabot and Lee's portfolio, captured dozens of prizes in North Atlantic waters over the course of the Revolutionary War, earning her owners great sums and immensely frustrating the Royal Navy. On just one cruise in 1777, she captured the brigantines Lovely Nancy, Rhoda, Queen of Portugal, Bayonne, Betsy, Lark, Endeavour, William and Mary, and 2 sisters, the Eastleigh and the Sloop Fly, 11 vessels in 5 months. She considered to be one of the colony's most prolific vessels of war until her service as an American privateer ended with her capture by a British frigate, HMS Maidstone, off Newfoundland in July of 1781. Privateering was, after all, a risky business. In 1782, Colonel John Trumbull, known as the Painter of the Revolution for his scenes of Independence Hall and the Battle of Bunker Hill, sailed as a passenger on one Cabot and Lee transatlantic voyage. Of Beverly Harbor, he later remarked, quote, "We found 11 other ships, all belonging to the same owners, Cabot and Lee, yet such are the vicissitudes of war and the elements, and before the close of the year, they were all lost by capture or wreck, and the house had not a single ship afloat on the ocean." To account for such vicissitudes, a captain's bravado had to be matched by shrewd decisions in a counting house back home. If the investor's goal was to have the largest possible impact on the global balance of sea power and throw profit to the wind, he was likely to accept much more risk in his ventures, while a financially driven investor would hedge his investments. But Cromwell's lucrative 1777 voyage shows the complexity of privateering during the Revolutionary War, especially through the story of her agent and part owner, Captain Joseph Lee. Born in 1744, Lee put to sea as a cabin boy at age 13. By his early 20s, he was serving as a captain of the brigantine Louisa, which was owned by his brothers-in-law, John and Andrew Cabot, and operated in trade between New England and Bilbao, Spain. In the early 1770s, Lee was a part owner in a number of Cabot vessels engaged in trade with Spain and the West Indies. He also operated a profitable distillery and a shipyard in Beverly, retaining a share of ownership in many vessels he designed or built. Splitting his time between Beverly and Boston, he was a participant in the Boston Tea Party in 1773, withdrawing full-time to Beverly after the blockade of Boston Harbor. Lee's participation in the Boston Tea Party reveals a tolerance for risk on behalf of the Patriot cause, perhaps indicating why he invested so much of his capital in privateering ventures. He clearly was swayed to a degree by patriotic fervor. His ledger shows him to have possessed many streams of income from his distillery, shipyard, coastal shipping operations, the consignment of salt cod, and farming. He had a choice. Heavy investment in privateering was not his only way to stay afloat through the war years. Yet, as the Revolutionary War gained momentum, Lee's portfolio in the general ledger shifted further toward privateering. Many American merchants holed up in Spain, which was officially neutral in the war until 1779, weathering the storm to see who won. Lee, however, had returned home from Bilbao in 1773 to swarm aboard East India Company ships with his fellow patriots to toss tea into Boston Harbor. In later years of the war, in what likely were not rational business decisions, farming, distilling, and fish consignment faded from his ledgers as he moved an ever-increasing share of his capital into the investment in insurance and insurance of privateers. Beginning with the first shots of the Revolutionary War, rebelling merchants faced a new risk by stepping out from under the umbrella of the large empire. Without a serious naval power to back their legitimacy, American privateers could be charged with piracy. The risk was laid plain by the Treasons Act of 1777, which bemoaned that a rebellion and war have been openly and traitorously levied and carried out in America, and acts of treason and piracy have been committed on the high seas. The act authorized the British government to immediately arrest anyone suspicious and impound their cargo. In 1774, Lee affirmed his loyalty to the Patriot cause, swearing an oath before the Charlestown Committee of Correspondence. This oath could be used as proof in a British court that Lee had committed treason, thereby forfeiting his property to the crown. In many cases, Lee's business practices reflected common diversification measures. The Cromwell herself had 12 owners, each holding shares ranging from 1/64th to 1/6th of the ship. Lee, the agent for the vessel, held only 1/12th of the capital. But in addition to his 1/12th of the ship, he was able to collect an agent's fee for all the vessels he managed and insured, such as fees from the other owners of the Cromwell, and to share dividends and payments on positions held jointly with his relatives. So the Cromwell's cruise off the coast of Bilbao allowed Lee to use his agents, with which he left funds until the end of the war, avoiding the risk of loss on the voyage home. A seemingly successful voyage, though, could turn quickly, ended by a roving British cruiser or a gale, leaving funds in Spain, still a neutral state at the time of Cromwell's cruise under Lee's management, insulated the investors against loss of funds during a wartime transatlantic voyage. and also set a hedge against the loss of assets in Massachusetts in case of an unfavorable military outcome. These financial good fortunes indicate the success of his risk mitigation strategies. During the war, the Cabots of Beverly and their brother-in-law Lee became enormously wealthy through their privateering ventures. From his owner's share of 1/12 of the prize sales and his 1% agent's commission, these net proceeds from the cruise came to about £13,000, roughly $4 million in 2025 dollars. Compared to his investment as laid out in his ledger for the voyage, this reflects a 450% return on investment. After the Cromwell was captured by the HMS Maidstone in 1781, she faded from the pages of history. As the British white ensign climbed to her masthead, her defeated crew doubtless would have shuddered at the thought of what lay ahead. They had sailed and fought together for several successful voyages, cruising far from home to defend their nascent country and open new economic opportunities. But their luck had run out on that July day off the coast of Newfoundland. The Treason Act, they knew, precluded any chance of a trial. After the crew turned in their arms, some likely would have been dropped off at a British-held port, such as Halifax or New York, or been taken to England. Others may have enlisted in the Royal Navy, or they may have been pressed into service. A few would have trickled home, some as paroled prisoners, some having found berths on other vessels, and some after more years of adventure. Lee and his office in Beverly would have written to contacts throughout the North Atlantic for news of his ship and his men. The Cromwell presumably would have lived on under a new name and new owners. New investors would have hoped to use her as a privateer once more, now against American shipping. In 1782, the London Gazette item announced to the Maidstone's officers and crew that their prize had been sold and they could collect their share of the proceeds on the first Thursday of every month for 3 years hence. The cycle continued. Privateering made the social order of seaboard Massachusetts. Historian Octavius Howe writes that the enterprising Lee Cabot family rose from obscurity before the war to becoming one of the most powerful clans in the state. He suggests that their rise from a small-scale shipping firm to one of New England's largest maritime operations began with a small and scattered venture in privateering and grew through the successful prize-taking voyages. A large part of this, he, like Porter, attributes to Lee's sound naval architecture and shrewd business decisions. Lee remained involved in shipping, shipbuilding, insurance, until his old age, accumulating enough wealth to give one of the largest charitable gifts of its time to support an early expansion of Massachusetts General Hospital. The Cabots, whose capital Lee managed during the Revolutionary War, were transformed through their privateering ventures into one of the most significant families in American history. Whereas, as Porter suggests, most privateering merchants slipped into poverty and obscurity by the later years of the war. The role of privateering in the American Revolution has been hotly contested ever since Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan argued it is not the taking of individual ships or convoys, be they few or many, that strikes down the money power of a nation. It is the possession of that overbearing power on the sea which drives the enemy's flag from it, or allows it only to appear as a fugitive. Privateers attack the enemy's shipping in small engagements, far from the dominating fleet battles Mahan had in mind. Many prizes were captured, but were they enough to turn the course of the war? Lee's approach to the business of privateering is one example among many, and does not prove the role of the guerre de course in cementing early American sea power. However, his story and that of the Oliver Cromwell is illustrative of the blend of patriotism and profit that has long shaped the maritime domain of the United States. While Lee reaped momentous returns from his privateering ventures, the substantial risks he took in both his investments and his public political role made an undeniable case for his devotion to the patriot cause. The Cromwell did, after all, capture a staggering volume of British shipping, and as the eminent maritime historian Samuel Eliot Morison has written, it was a great war. And you're listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal. And now we're going to turn to The Black Loyalist, an article from The Atlantic by Andrew Lawler. Thousands of African Americans fought for the British, then fled the United States to avoid a return to enslavement. The man who had come to be called Harry Washington was born near the Gambia River in West Africa around 1740. As a young man, he was sold into slavery and endured the horrors of the Middle Passage. In Virginia, he was purchased by a neighbor of George Washington, who then bought the young man in 1763 for 40 pounds. After working to drain the colony's Great Dismal Swamp, one of George Washington's many land ventures, he was sent to Mount Vernon to care for the horses. Then came the war. With General Washington in Massachusetts leading the Continental Army, Harry Washington, like thousands of other enslaved people, abandoned the plantation, risking torture and imprisonment for joining the British cause. In exchange for his freedom, he enlisted in what was known as the Ethiopian Regiment. Virginia's royal governor, Lord Dunmore, had created a base to oppose the rebels near the port of Norfolk in the summer of 1775. Encouraged by the large numbers of enslaved people who sought sanctuary behind British lines, he published British Empire's first Emancipation Proclamation in November, granting liberty to any person in bondage owned by patriots who would take up arms for King George III. These recruits, Harry Washington among them, formed the Empire's first black regiment. Together with Dunmore, they launched what would amount to the biggest slave insurrection in the nation's history until the Civil War. Their uniforms bore the motto, "Liberty for Slaves," a tart retort to the liberty or death slogan favored by patriots. The prospect of freed black men armed and trained by the British terrified white patriots. George Washington, who had been a close friend of the royal governor before the war, now referred to him as that arch traitor to the rights of humanity. He worried that Dunmore and his multiracial army, which also included regiments of British redcoats and white loyalists, were fast becoming his own men's most formidable enemy. Continental Congress made it the first mission of the U.S. Navy to crush Dunmore's troops, and later sent General Charles Lee, second only to Washington in rank, to defeat them. Both campaigns failed. In May of 1776, as the representatives in Philadelphia remained divided over whether to declare independence, the Virginia delegation, convinced that Dunmore's alliance with black Americans made negotiation with Britain impossible, broke the deadlock, unanimously urging separation from the mother country. Within months, a combination of patriot artillery, smallpox, typhus, and drought forced Dunmore and his surviving soldiers and their families to retreat from Virginia to New York City. There, Harry Washington and others joined the successful British invasion of the city and were absorbed into the Black Pioneers, a military construction unit founded by British General Henry Clinton. Washington then went on to serve in an artillery unit in Charleston, South Carolina. By the war's end, some 20,000 black Americans had served as active members of the British military, about three times as many as had fought as patriots. Many tens of thousands more had fled plantations to support the king's cause by cooking, cleaning, and caring for livestock. Their motives for allying with the British, then the world's foremost slave traffickers, were clear. Emancipation was not on the Continental Congress agenda. "Slaves are devils," one Virginia patriot wrote, "and to make them otherwise than slaves will be to set devils free." For their part, British leaders like Dunmore did not necessarily oppose slavery or consider those in bondage to be their equal. Many were willing to back mass liberation as a tool to crush the rebellion. Dunmore had made his decree without approval from London, but it was never repudiated. This encouraged General Clinton to issue his own in 1779, although he declined to arm black men. That same year, the British Commandant of New York, David Jones, proclaimed, "All Negroes that fly from the enemy's country are free. No person, whatever can claim, can claim a right to them." Not every British military leader agreed. When British General Lord Cornwallis invaded the South, he refused to consider freeing black allies, much less arming them. Nevertheless, thousands volunteered to assist in the fight against their owners. The British loss at Yorktown in 1781 was a catastrophe for the many black Americans who now found themselves facing the prospect of being forced back into slavery. Some 10,000 scattered across four continents. They built the largest North American settlement of emancipated people in Canada, melted into German city-states, eked out a precarious living on the streets of London, endured the brutality of Australia's convict colony, and established the first home in Africa for people freed from bondage. The story of black loyalists and their post-war diaspora highlights an irony long ignored. Thousands of those with the biggest stake in securing liberty ultimately had to flee a country founded on the premise that all are created equal. Almost as soon as Cornwallis surrendered to George Washington at Yorktown, marking the end of major military operations, victorious white Americans sought to recover what they considered their stolen property. Washington retrieved seven people who had fled Mount Vernon. Thomas Jefferson recovered five people, some of whom he later sold at auction. Virginia Governor Benjamin Harrison fruitlessly sought the return of Emmanuel, a good barber. Cornwallis looked the other way when a few favored black loyalists boarded the Royal Navy warship Bonetta for transport to New York, which was still under British control. Other officers went further, evacuating large numbers of black Americans, despite bitter protests by patriot slave owners. During the British withdrawal from Savannah, Georgia, and Charleston in 1782, about 10,000 black Americans sailed away. Scanty records make it difficult to determine their identities, their destinations, or even how many had been freed during the conflict. Some likely remained the property of white loyalists who fled the young nation after their defeat. At least 3,000 black Americans arrived in British-controlled St. Augustine, and more are daily coming, the governor of East Florida wrote. Others landed in Jamaica or the Bahamas, where many were trapped in bondage on pineapple and sugar plantations. A British investigation found that a few unscrupulous officers had sold free people into bondage, though the authorities forbade the practice. At least 400 refugees reached England, where slavery was not legal, but life was difficult nonetheless. A Quaker may have been referring to them when he observed in 1785 the almost naked and miserable Negro prostrate at many a corner in London. At least one black American, John Caesar, was found guilty of theft and sent on the first fleet of ships bearing convicts to Australia, where he became a legendary figure who refused to bow to his jailers. Several dozen black Americans, mostly young men who had served as drummers in the mercenary Hessian units, made their way to Germany as free men. Their fates are difficult to track, but one, at least, prospered, married well, and had the gracious Landgrave himself, a nobleman, as a sponsor at his child's baptism, the historian writes. When another died in the city of Kassel, his corpse was dissected in the town's anatomy theater, proving to the astonished witnesses that under the black skin, he was just like a white man. By late 1782, New York was the sole American port still under British control. George Washington's army was encamped about 60 miles north of the Hudson River, on the Hudson River, as Harry Washington and thousands of his fellow black loyalists crowded into tenements and refugee camps across the city. Whether they would be surrendered to the victorious patriots and returned to slavery, or find freedom in some distant land, remained uncertain. On November 30th, 1782, American and British negotiators were in the final hours of completing a peace treaty in the drawing room of a Harris mansion when Henry Lawrence, a wealthy South Carolinian planter, appeared at the door. Lawrence had been captured in 1780 while crossing the Atlantic and had been imprisoned in the Tower of London. A year after being exchanged for Cornwallis, he arrived in Paris. He was aghast when he learned that the Americans, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, and John Adams, were poised to sign a document that made no provision for the recovery of men and women the patriots had held in bondage. Mr. Lawrence said there ought to be a stipulation that the British troops should carry off no Negroes or other American property. Adams wrote in his diary, "We all agreed. Mr. Oswald, the lead British negotiator, consented." Word of the last-minute addition arrived in North America in 1783. The Continental Congress ordered George Washington, General Washington, to arrange for the delivery of all Negroes and other property of the inhabitants of the United States in possession of the British forces. Harrison, the governor of Virginia, made a personal plea to the general, "I observe by a clause in the articles, we are to have our Negroes again," he said. "I have 30 missing, many of which I understand are dead. There are still some that are very valuable. My well-being depends on their being recovered," he said. By then, rumors were spreading that the commander-in-chief of the British forces, Sir Guy Carleton, would override the treaty by evacuating black Americans. Panicked enslavers decided to act. On April 28th, George Washington asked a New York-based merchant to locate and return some 20 enslaved people who had escaped Mount Vernon, including Harry Washington, Boston King, a freed South Carolinian then living in the city, recalled in his memoir that we saw our masters coming from Virginia, North Carolina, and other parts and seizing upon their slaves in the streets of New York. George Washington, meanwhile, demanded a meeting with Carleton. He aimed to fix a date for the British withdrawal and insisted that the British return the enslaved property. Carleton responded that the Americans' demand was inconsistent with prior engagements, binding the national honor, which must be kept. Citing the Dunmore and Clinton proclamations, he explained that the black loyalists were already free. He would not allow them to be returned to bondage and subjected to severe punishment, or perhaps even execution, by their former owners. Washington ended the meeting abruptly. That night, in a letter to his British adversary, he warned that he was prepared to take any measures which may be deemed expedient prevent the future carrying away of any Negroes. The implication was that the Continental Army was prepared to march into New York City to recover people whom they considered patriot property. Carleton stood firm, responding that as a British official, he had no right to prevent their going to any part of the world they thought proper. Added archly that any breach of the public faith would people of any complexion reflected poorly on the new nation. Writing to Franklin in Paris, Elias Boudinot, Confederation Congress president, said that the British move had, quote, irritated the citizens of America to an alarming degree, end quote. Members of Virginia's assembly, which was made up mostly of slave-owning planters, recommended halting the release of British prisoners until Carleton reversed course. In Philadelphia, James Madison decried the British general's decision as a shameful evasion. There was even discussion of reactivating the Continental Army, as Washington had hinted in his letter to Carleton. Congress decided not to challenge the British, fearing, as one member put it, a renewal of hostilities might be the consequence. Amid much grumbling, the idea was shelved. American enslavers hoped that King George would force Carleton's compliance with the treaty provision. The monarch gave the general's interpretation his enthusiastic approval. The British Secretary of State concluded that it was certainly an act of justice due to them, the black loyalists, from us. An internal British government memo accused Washington of acting in the manner, quote, with all the grossness and ferocity of a captain of banditti. Black loyalists were grateful to learn that Carleton was not planning to leave them at the mercy of the patriots, and in the summer of 1783, they lined up outside Francis Tavern to request permission to leave New York. When their turn came, the men and women stood before a panel of British officers in the tavern's long room, the same room where, a few months later, General Washington would give his farewell address to officers following the British evacuation of the city and the war's official conclusion. At the end of July, Harry Washington and Boston King, along with his wife Violet, boarded L'Abondance, a French cargo ship that had been captured by the British. Along with 3,000 others, they had received certificates of freedom signed by Brigadier General Samuel Burge, granting them permission to go to Nova Scotia or wherever else they would not allow themselves to be enslaved again. In a clearing carved out of dense forest in southwestern Nova Scotia, a striking modern building of glass and steel houses, Black Loyalist Heritage Center stands. The museum commemorates what was once the largest free black community outside of Africa, made up of displaced Americans. Most of their descendants long ago moved away, but a restored church and a school remain, along with the battered house foundations hidden in thick foliage. 410 passengers on L'Abondance landed nearby at the port of Shelburne. The indigenous people had long lived there. The British officials were eager to repopulate an area that was sparsely settled after the eviction of Acadians, descendants of French colonizers, in the 1750s. Lured by promises of free land, copious provisions, and no taxes, white American loyalists were flocking to the site, and many brought their human chattel, who would remain enslaved in their new home. The emancipated black refugees, who also were promised British support, immediately encountered indifference from the authorities and outright hostility from the white Americans. Most were denied sufficient land and supplies. They were forced to seek menial work for low wages, which angered unemployed white residents. Less than a year after the black refugees arrived, in July of 1784, a mob attacked and destroyed nearly 24 of their homes in the Shelburne outskirts. Some thousands of people assembled with clubs and drove the Negroes out of the town, one Nova Scotian reported. Only the arrival of British troops halted the brutality. Many displaced residents retreated to a black settlement across the harbor called Birchtown after the man who had certified their freedom. But interminable winters, inadequate rations, and continued white wrath made survival an ongoing struggle. On Nova Scotia's west coast, in the town of Annapolis Royal, Thomas Peters encountered similarly desperate conditions. Peters, who was born in Africa, had been enslaved in North Carolina. He made his way to New York and joined the Black Pioneers. With his wife Sally and their two children, Peters took part in the exodus to Nova Scotia in 1783 and soon emerged as a leader of his community's 200 Black Loyalists, scraping by as a millwright while awaiting his promised acreage. In 1790, still waiting, Peter, then 52, sailed to London to report the grievances of his people. Any black man traveling alone by ship risked the re-enslavement by rapacious crews. Peters arrived safely with his petition, and through the abolitionist Granville Sharp was able to get with British government officials. Sharp had spearheaded a 1787 effort to create a province of freedom on the West African coast, recruiting members of London's poor black community. More than 400 settlers, including freed black Americans, had landed in St. George's Bay, about 500 miles south of the Gambia River, to found Granville Town. Conflict with local peoples, most of whom had recently converted to Islam and resented the Christian invaders, soon led to the settlement's dissolution. Sharp and his fellow abolitionists, Thomas Clarkson and William Wilberforce, were now attempting to approach an approach that offered commercial as well as moral benefits, wooing investors with the promise that a West African colony of free black people would prove of great national importance to the manufactories and other trading interests of this kingdom. Shortly after Peter's arrival, they had overcome fierce opposition from slave interests to create the Sierra Leone Company. Although they had little success enlisting settlers for this new venture, Peters was excited to hear of their plans, and his enthusiasm reinvigorated the Sault project. He returned to Nova Scotia with the task of persuading black loyalists to once again relocate, this time across the Atlantic. Thomas Clarkson's younger brother John, a naval officer in his 20s, accompanied Peters as the company representative. While Peters went to the province's west coast, Clarkson sailed down the east coast to drum up recruits in Birchtown. He was shocked to find the people there kept in the most abject state of servitude. And on a rainy day in October of 1791, hundreds of people crammed into the Methodist chapel Christian Clarkson. They knew of the disaster that had befallen Granville Town. They wanted assurances of land, provisions, no annual rent in their prospective new home. Clarkson sympathized. People will not consider how often they have been deceived and how suspicious they are in consequence, he wrote, and how necessary it is to be open and candid with them. This time, he insisted, would be different. Some of the black loyalists remained unconvinced. Still, 514 of the town's residents signed up within 3 days, and more expected to join. Peters gathered 132 others, and in December, Harry Washington, Boston, and Violet King, and hundreds of others gathered in Halifax to prepare to emigrate. Clarkson, not Peters, would lead the voyage. The Nova Scotia governor, who had given his blessing to the venture, called Clarkson a fit person to have the charge of said free blacks. And on January 15th, 1792, 1,100 passengers, each with a document guaranteeing their right to a plot of land in Africa, boarded 15 ships and set sail. The settlers, a mix of ardent Baptists and Methodists, came ashore in Sierra Leone in March of 1792, singing, "The Year the Jubilee Is Come." Harry Washington and Thomas Peters were some of only a handful of passengers who had seen Africa before. Most had parents and grandparents born in North America. The historian Ira Berlin has written that these newcomers brought to West Africa a peculiarly American brand of evangelical Christianity, commercial capitalism, and political republicanism. They called their coastal settlement Freetown. Less than 20 miles upstream stood the notorious British slave trading fort on Bunce Island, which remained in operation. Colonists also had to navigate relations with the indigenous peoples in the area, much as their predecessors in Granville Town had. But the primary tensions were between the black settlers and their managers, an 8-person governing council of white men. John Clarkson, who had been named governor, had only a single vote. Though Clarkson had limited power, Peters was excluded from governance altogether. Within weeks, with supplies dwindling and no land allocated, the colonists chafed under the, quote, noxious arrogance of their rulers, end quote. That's according to Anna Maria Falconbridge, who was married to the colony's surgeon and wrote the first history of the settlement. On Easter Sunday, a month after landing, Peters confronted John Clarkson with a petition outlining the settlers' grievances. Receiving this as a direct challenge to his authority, Clarkson ordered the town's bell rung and declared publicly that one or other of us would be hanged upon that tree before the dispute was settled. The assembled crowd, spooked by this sudden ultimatum, declined to back Peters, who walked away in disgust. Peters' sudden death 2 months later, likely from malaria, removed the biggest challenge to Clarkson's rule. But on the day he died, the settlers presented the governor with two petitions, one insisting that black men serve as peace officers. We can have rules and regulations among ourselves, they argued, while still honoring British law. Clarkson negotiated a compromise, but he was locked in his own disputes with company directors in London, who demanded immediate financial returns. He sailed for Britain at the end of 1792, promising to advocate for settlers. In London, however, the company refused to abide by the pledges Clarkson had made in Nova Scotia. He was dismissed, never to return to Freetown. Still, black settlers continued to send him letters in subsequent years requesting his intervention on their behalf, a tragic testament to the trust they placed in him long after he had moved on, as well as a sign of their mounting desperation. The council in Sierra Leone, meanwhile, ignored the pleas for land by black settlers who continued to fight for their dignity. We have not the education which white men have, the petition stated, yet we have feelings the same as other human beings. Last summer, the settlers Cato Perkins and Isaac Anderson, veterans of Dunmore's regiment, sailed to London to present the complaint to the company's directors, asking for, quote, nothing but what you promised us, end quote. The directors refused to consider the petition. Freetown's black settlers eventually organized their own legal system and elected an assembly. The white overseers refused to recognize it. And so in 1800, the heads of 150 families, likely representing about half the settlement's homes, meant to announce that their law system would soon go into effect, essentially declaring independence from the white-controlled government. One of them was Harry Washington. When the colony's marshal attempted to arrest the faction's leaders, Washington retreated to the outskirts of town with 40 or so others. The British quickly put down the uprising and captured the rebels. 31 men were tried for open and unprovoked rebellion. 2 were hanged. Others, including Washington, were banished to the far shore of the Sierra Leone River. Washington was named the head of this group, but the paper trail ends there. His final fate is unknown. The Sierra Leone Company did not survive the turmoil, and the British government took over Sierra Leone in 1808, a year after Parliament outlawed the slave trade. The new governor was appalled to find a colony of, quote, runaway slaves, end quote, filled with absurd enthusiasm in their religion and wild notions of liberty in their politics. They displayed, he added, everything that is vile in the American. Relations between the British rulers and black settlers remained tense. After 1819, the Royal Navy used Freetown as a base for its anti-slaving campaign, a relocation center for those intercepted on slave ships, and soon after, the capital of British West Africa. Occasional rebellions were brutally suppressed, And only in 1961 did Sierra Leone's black population gain independence. Today, citizens in Sierra Leone and Nova Scotia continue to honor their black American roots. But elsewhere, the diaspora that followed the American Revolution has largely been forgotten. It ought not to be. The unlikely alliance between British military leaders and enslaved Americans, in fact, helped plant the seeds for broader emancipation. Individuals like Washington and Peters demonstrated that those who had been enslaved were as willing to fight and die for the British Empire as any other redcoat, chipping away at entrenched notions of racial inferiority. And in Nova Scotia and Sierra Leone, they boldly demanded equal justice, representation in government, and a measure of prosperity. After imposing its 1807 ban on the slave trade, Britain abolished slavery throughout the empire in 1833. In the young United States, enslavers would not soon forget what they saw as Britain's theft of their property, but American abolitionists, such as John Quincy Adams, would come to view Britain's wartime proclamations as important legal precedents in their own struggle and lifetime servitude. A Massachusetts lawyer named Benjamin Butler had also studied the British documents. When the Civil War began in 1861, he was made commander of Fort Monroe near Norfolk, which remained in Union hands. Shortly after Butler arrived, enslaved men who had been ordered to dig trenches for the Confederates sought refuge at the fort. General Butler declared them spoils of war and refused to hand them over to the enemy. Out of this incident seemed to have grown one of the most sudden and important revolutions in popular thought, which took place during the whole war, wrote two of President Abraham Lincoln's secretaries. Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts privately lobbied Lincoln to emancipate and arm black Americans. The president feared this move would incur a court challenge from white Northerners. Sumner, however, insisted that the edicts made by British leaders at Dunmore during the Revolution provided the necessary legal cover. This argument eventually persuaded Lincoln. His famous 1863 Emancipation Proclamation was, like those made some nine decades before, tentative and conditional. This time, however, it sounded like the death knell for the American institution of slavery. Hats and bonnets were in the air, and we have three cheers for Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass wrote after witnessing a reading of the decree in New York City, and three cheers for about everyone else. Those cheers should sound for black patriots, fraught for American independence, as well as for exiled black loyalists like Harry Washington, who helped pave the way for a nation more willing to uphold its most vaunted ideal. And again, you're listening to Audio Journals, All Things History. And now we can spend a little time on black patriots. Okay, an American Black Patriots. This is an article from the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. And I don't have time to read the whole thing, unfortunately, because it's pretty interesting. Approximately 5,000 soldiers in the American Revolution were men of color. Sharing much of the same experience as white men, these black veterans nevertheless encountered their own distinct challenges. Mark Murray, a light mulatto freeman, refused to act as a servant to a white officer and had to appeal up the chain of command to remain a combat soldier. It was common practice for white officers to tap men of color to tend their needs. Jacob Francis went by two names during the war. He used his master's surname, Ulick, when serving under Washington, but once told by his mother his real surname, Wilder identified with his father thereafter and became a Francis. Many men of color changed their surname to denote their new status as men fighting for their country's cause. After the war, Jacob Francis married a woman he bought out of slavery. much decorated Robin Starr, who had earned awards for service that most white soldiers never achieved and bore the scars of serving on the battlefields of the Revolution, lived to see his state of Connecticut write a new constitution in 1818 that banned all men of color from voting. Mark Murray and Jacob Francis joined Starr in being expelled from full citizenship in the 19th century by the states they had fought for in the moment of crisis. All of these men were from New England and grew up in a world that did not question slavery. Aside from a few Quakers and a handful of black people who were allowed to resort to the courts, slavery was a given in everyday life. The institution existed in every colony of what would become the United States. Thomas Jefferson said slavery was a part of the monotonous course of daily life. That changed when fighting broke out between the colonists and the mother country. Enslaved people could not be ignored in the war, particularly when they accounted for 20% of the population. The British were the first to realize this and act on it in 1775. As we mentioned earlier, Lord Dunmore, the royal governor of Virginia, issued a proclamation offering immediate freedom to all indentured servants, blacks, or others belonging to rebels, who would promptly bear arms in the interest of quelling the insurgents. Here was a power center offering freedom to the enslaved, even eventually taking in women and children. The Patriot side extended no such comparable offer to African Americans. In fact, the Continental Congress forbade enlisting men of color, whether free or enslaved. In short order, African-American veterans of early New England battles demanded that they be reinstated. Washington described them as being much dissatisfied and advised the Congress that soldiers who felt discarded could seek employ elsewhere, i.e. with the British. Both the National Congress and most state legislatures eventually opened up enlistment to all healthy men. The first couple of years of the war, African Americans had to fight, be able to fight. Why did they enlist? Camaraderie, commitment to a cause, adventure, financial considerations, all figured into it. White and black men's decisions to join or stay in military service. But for black men, these reasons took on a different slant by dint of their position in society. For example, a black recruit would buy the enlistment bounties of cash and land as a way to buy his own freedom or the freedom of a family member. Adventure, too, looks a shade different. To an African-American recruit, the rush of seeing faraway places would have been all the more exciting to men whose mobility had been the most limited before the war. While laws opened the way for black participation in the war, men themselves had to make the decision. First of all, they had a real alternative with the British Army. They then had to calculate the odds that the states and masters would live up to their word and that they themselves, as soldiers, would survive to reap the benefits. And the soaring words on the revolutionary side might have led black recruits to believe that their service would bring a better world to their families and communities. None of these scenarios was a foregone conclusion when African-American men made their marks on the enlistment papers. African-American soldiers served longer stints than did their white counterparts, and did so for the most part in integrated companies of militia and army. Only Rhode Island created an all-black regiment by briefly offering freedom to slaves who served until the end of the war. A few other companies were peopled exclusively by black rank and file, but all officers in these units were white. The fact that African Americans served in integrated units did not mean that they lived in an integrated daily life. An African American friend of Primus Lane recalled that Prime and myself were frequently together, we both being black men. Primus Lane spent a part of his service as a waiter to a white officer. Black men more often served as wagon drivers and servants than did white men. Still, most shared the physical danger of engaging with the enemy. Southern states' laws, like those of Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, tried to detach black men from guns by limiting their service to support duties. But evidence on the ground, as provided by the pension records, indicate that Southern black men were in the thick of battle, more Southerners noted being wounded than soldiers from the north of the Pennsylvania and Maryland border. Morgan Griffin's daughter claimed that her father was wounded 7 times when a South Carolina soldier, while a South Carolina soldier. Elisha Hunt of North Carolina lost his right arm in Charleston. Tim Jones of Virginia lost a leg. The Army offered sparse rations, drafty quarters, and considerable danger. But the uniform also meant mobility, adventure, and the opportunity of teaming with white countrymen in pursuit of a lofty goal. Military service also provided an outlet for men to be forceful, to take initiative, and to engage in aggressive behavior. Record Prime, a poor freeman from North Carolina, described how he and his brothers in arms whipped the British and Tories. Another veteran from New Jersey, Oliver Cromwell, informed the pension office in 1818, quote, "We nuked the British about lively," end quote, at Trenton and Princeton. The veterans' children and grandchildren who joined the early black abolition movement repeatedly cited the sacrifice of black men in the American Revolution. After the war, these veterans mounted a frontal assault in their local courthouses to claim their pensions, claiming themselves worthy in a post-war society that went about systematically demeaning anyone of their skin color. The vets made sure no one was going to deny them their place in the formation of the nation. The struggle of 76 was an ongoing one for these veterans, and they passed it along to further generations who labored and who continued to labor to realize the promises of the great revolutionary documents. All we have time for, you've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone or iPad. This is Sue Robesky, and if you're a history buff, we would love to hear your thoughts and ideas on an interesting topic for us to investigate. Thanks for listening.
When someone you know is struggling with vision loss, it can be challenging. But the Mass Commission for the Blind is here to help. We'll connect them to resources that will help them plan for the future with new skills and assistive technology. Find out if they're eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450. Or visit mass.gov/MCB.
This is Bird Note. This chatty fellow is a marsh wren, a sprightly brown bird with a cocked tail. Wrens are known for their amazing singing, including loud, complex vocalizations. And they have a huge repertoire of songs. Some bird lovers have tagged the marsh wren the Heinz 57 variety bird because scientists have recorded 57 different variations of its song. That's quite a mix of notes. Listen for one often repeated phrase, though, a recurring chugging, like the sound of a sewing machine or a toy machine gun. Nightfall doesn't faze them. A male may sing straight through the night. Opinions differ when it comes to describing the singing of the marsh wren. Ornithologist Alexander Wilson said its song sounded like air bubbles forcing their way through mud. John James Audubon said its song, if song I can call it, resembles the grating of a rusty hinge. Today, though, all would agree this is just one of many species to benefit from the North American Wetlands Conservation Act. Marsh wrens usually forage out of view, hopping up only for brief moments. You're most likely to see movement among the cattails, and not even see the bird unless it pops up on a cattail to see what you're doing. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.